From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. Our big conversation today is about leadership. We'll discuss the qualities that make a great leader and how you can become one and what tools are necessary to be successful. We're also looking at what leaders are doing during this extremely challenging time, as Governor Newsom would say, to meet the moment. For that, we're going to start in our own backyard. Sacramento has what's referred to as a weak mayor system, which doesn't reflect on how a mayor governs a city, but on how much power the mayor actually has in relation to other elected officials. In Sacramento's case, the city manager's office typically has more power than the mayor's office, and that power structure is now being challenged by Mayor Daryl Steinberg, who would like to see the city run like his big city counterparts in San Francisco and Los Angeles. Today, the Sacramento City Council will vote on a proposed ballot measure to switch to what's called a strong mayor system at Steinberg's request. And here to talk about the history and the current proposal is Cap Radio's Sarah Mises-Tan. Sarah, good to see you.
Good morning, Randall. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's been a little while, so nice to see your face here on Zoom is what we're using. So what is the debate going on right now with the strong mayor ballot proposition?
Sure. Yeah. And it has been certainly a healthy debate. There are some very strong community voices in opposition right now that have made their position pretty well heard last week during the city council meeting last Tuesday. So namely, many of the people who have been involved in leading a lot of the efforts for police reform, racial equity in the city, have felt that this ballot item was what they say is a quote unquote power grab by the mayor, and that it was a ballot item that put mayoral power first and equity second. Mm. As some may remember, in the original ballot item, there was both a strong mayor provision and equity provisions, both woven together, and a number of advocates did not like that the two were together under one ballot vote. Other advocates felt that just the time was wrong for a move like this, and that the city didn't trust Mayor Daryl Steinberg to wield more power, as that's not what they elected him to do. Here's Sonia Lewis. She's an organizer and leader of the Liberation Collective for Black Sacramento.
We recognize that there are some limitations in the way that the mayor's structuring and the just city structure of power as it exists. I mean, there is always a catch-22 on these things, especially since we are under a system where a city manager holds all of the keys. While on one hand, this is a very potentially good move for the city, we just don't think that Mayor Steinberg deserves to be a strong mayor.
So, Sarah, if I understand what Sonia Lewis is saying there, she thinks, maybe strong mayor would work for Sacramento, but not under the current leadership.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of an interesting perspective. There are, of course, other people who have been involved in some of these more grassroots organizations leading this effort. They just feel strong mayor is not the type of government that they want for Sacramento. Uh-huh. But Lewis did kind of hint at the fact that, yeah, she does think that right now the city manager is very, very powerful, and that he's not somebody who is elected by voters in Sacramento. And so in some ways, you know, that is a difficult situation to be enacting equity changes.
Yeah.
But at the same time, yeah, she just said, you know, the mayor's not right now. He's not the right person.
I want to get back to the equity issue that you mentioned in there. There originally was some wording apparently that was tied to this the strong mayor ballot initiative that got removed. Who originally put it in and then who took it out?
So I do believe, I think Mayor Steinberg proposed the ballot measure. And so he is the one who put in both a strong mayor proposal in addition to some equity proposals. So things like a participatory budget or electing a commission to look at equity. Mm-hmm. Those things are all together. They are still together right now, but what he has added is the ability to unbundle these two. So City Council could vote to do that during tonight's meeting.
All right. Speaking of tonight's meeting, tell us about the tone of last week's council meeting.
Sure. Yeah. There were dozens and dozens of public comment that came in from everyone from residents to City Council member elect Katie Valenzuela to, of course, a number of the advocates that we saw who have been leading the movement here for racial equity. All of them weighed in, said that they were not in favor of having a strong mayor ballot item be put to voters. And city council members certainly had a lot of questions, though they were maybe not as strongly opposed. We kind of had an even split between council members who were in support, council members who were strongly opposed, and council members who were still on the fence.
And Council Member Carr had something to say here. I believe we've got some sound on that.
Yes, sorry. Here's Council Member Larry Carr. He was probably one of the strongest members in opposition to the measure. Here he is.
And what they concluded was that city manager, council forms of government were at least 10% more efficient than strong mayor forms of government. And why did they say that? Because professional management works. If you have a professional running your city, it works. If you have an elected representative running your city, you're much less effective, much less efficient.
So clearly, Councilmember Carr there opposed to the strong mayor and saying that really the person that should be making these calls is the person who's, you know, gone to college for these sorts of decisions.
Exactly. Yeah, he's essentially saying that, you know, someone like Howard Chan is somebody who knows how to do this job, knows how to do it well, and he's the best person, or any person who's hired as a city manager is the best person in place to run the city.
And so then what's the mayor's argument?
Yeah, Steinberg argued that a lot of the equity issues that Sacramento struggles with can't be addressed without a strong mayor, interestingly. So here he is.
But here is the fundamental reality of our city governance today. That is, its primary responsibility is to assure the health of the city organization. Its primary responsibility is not to invest its resources into the neighborhoods and the community, especially the neighborhoods and communities that have been long left behind. Ask yourself this: why has there never been a consistent economic equity agenda in our city?
The mayor, yeah, again, tying equity to this issue.
Exactly. Yeah. It seems for him, you know, I think he is open to separating the items into two separate ballot measures, a ballot measure about equity changes to the city charter and a ballot measure about the strong mayor proposal. But for him personally, I do think that he believes that the two are very closely tied together.
So California's largest cities, except for San Jose and Sacramento, have this strong mayor structure within their city. Why is it? Why does it seem to work better at these larger levels? Or maybe it doesn't work better there at all. Who knows?
It's probably up for debate whether or not it works better or not. But certainly proponents of Sacramento's ballot proposal say that this was in some ways a natural progression for Sacramento, a city that's grown a lot in the last few years. They say that many other large cities, like you said, Los Angeles, Oakland, San Francisco, Fresno, they all have strong mayor forms of government. Although, of course, opponents will also argue that in places like Oakland, having a strong mayor has not been to the benefit of greater equity changes. For various different reasons. So, mm-hmm. You know, I think it can kind of go either way, but certainly the large cities in California do have a strong mayor.
So in order to change this structure, you would have to change the city charter, right? And then that's why it has to be put up to the voters?
Exactly. Yeah. So we're talking about changes that aren't just going to be throughout this current city council's term or throughout Mayor Steinberg's term, but these are changes that would exist beyond their terms and past them.
You mentioned that there, at least during the last city council meeting, there was a pretty even split. Give us the breakdown on who's for, who's against, and who's on that, you know, proverbial fence right now.
Yeah. So right now we had three council members who were fully in support of the measure. There was Council Member Rick Jennings, Council Member Angelique Ashby, and Council Member Jay Chenier all seemed to be open to putting this proposal up to the voters. There were three who were firmly opposed. Larry Carr was one of them. And then there were two council members who were undecided, Eric Guerra and Steve Hansen. They had a lot of questions for the mayor, but they did seem interested to hear more from the mayor and interested in a possibility of potentially splitting that ballot into two separate items.
And you mentioned that council member elect Katie Valenzuela was there. How did she fall on this issue?
Council member elect Katie Valenzuela was strongly opposed to this. She felt that having a strong mayor was not right for the moment that Sacramento is having right now and not the right form of government for Sacramento in general. She did point out that San Jose has been struggling with this question and has decided not to move forward on bringing this to the ballot. And she mentioned that there are potentially alternate forms of government that Sacramento could be considering that could potentially give a mayor slightly more power, but might be a little more equitable, like a city council chamber situation.
And she will be replacing Councilmember Hansen, Steve Hansen, coming up, who currently is a fence sitter. So that would make up a very different council moving forward. What happens if tonight we end up with 4-4?
I guess
the mayor would decide that. Right.
I think there certainly is, you know, for me, I do think that there is a strong possibility that this could go on the ballot to voters. You know, I think we had three members of council who were very strongly in favor of this. And then we had two who were kind of on the fence, but seemed to feel that if this measure could be separated into two ballot items, one about equity, one about the strong mayor, mm-hmm. that they would be more in support of it. And so I wouldn't be surprised if tonight we see that this does end up going to voters, maybe in two forms.
Right. Yeah. Sarah, this isn't the first time the city of Sacramento has grappled with this issue.
No, it's not. Mayor Kevin Johnson back in 2014 also proposed a strong mayor ballot item, and voters said no to that. And so a lot of people who are opposed and who voiced their opposition in the public comment section mentioned that Sacramento voters have already said their stance on this not very long ago. They don't feel that the situation is any different.
I guess we're just in a different, I mean, clearly we're in a different time, but there are some challenges facing this mayor that certainly were not before Mayor Johnson back in 2014. And maybe Mayor Steinberg's calculus is that will make the difference.
Yeah, definitely. Mayor Steinberg says that right now, the mayor who has been elected by the people of Sacramento is being held accountable for things he doesn't necessarily have control over. He mentioned the allocation of money from the Measure U sales tax, for example, and the fact that though he promised it to voters to go towards underserved communities, he also has no control over the actual city budget that currently falls under the city manager. So he believed that equity changes in the city and a strong mayor really do go hand in hand.
Sarah, we don't have much time left, but you just mentioned Measure U, and I cannot let you go without talking about that, because I know that you've reported on it quite a bit. And there is this group of people who are put together to help ensure that the Measure U funds are spent correctly. It's a committee, right? And this show is about leadership today, and they're really taking this moment and stepping up to their roles.
Yeah, the Measure, I would say, kind of potentially a surprise. Maybe a lot of people had not paid attention to the Measure U committee meetings in the past. They are a group of community officials from the community who have been selected by council members. And the Measure U committee has really stepped up kind of as a voice for equity in a lot of ways. I think when the city budget showed that money from the Measure U sales tax was being reallocated as a result of the COVID crisis and that it would not end up going to its intended goal initially, the committee has really stepped forward. You know, we know names like Dr. Flojan Kofer now, who's right. The chair of that committee, who have come out really strongly advocating for greater equity within the city.
All right. Cap Radio reporter Sarah Mises-Tan, you'll be at the, well, can you, this is open, the special council meeting?
It will be a public meeting. Yeah. So anyone and everyone can tune in.
Okay, great, Sarah. And we look forward to your reporting on it tonight and tomorrow during Morning Edition. Thanks so much for the update.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
All right. Just ahead, we're going to hear from an expert on leadership who studies politics and says, like with the strong mayor argument, that the presidency of the United States needs more power. And a bit later, how to be a better leader in the workplace.
Life's too short to work with jerks. Don't hire them. Don't enable them. Don't be them.
Yeah, do not be them. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White, and we're back in just a moment. We'll be right back.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and our focus today is leadership. Are leaders born? Are they made? Wherever leadership originates, it always comes in handy when you're building something from scratch, right? Amid the coronavirus pandemic, leaders have emerged at every level, from local county health directors to state governors. But someone has to take responsibility, and if that leadership is dished up the right way, that same someone gets to take credit. Governor Gavin Newsom alone has had as much praise as he's had criticism over the past handful of months. President Donald Trump's role at the center of the U.S. response to COVID-19 continues to be a hot-button topic. The ultimate praise or criticism will likely end up at the ballot box roughly 3 months from just about today. One person who carefully watches how all of this leadership plays out is Professor William Howell. He's a presidential scholar and Sidney Stein professor in American politics at the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. And he joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me, Randall. It's good to be with you.
Likewise. So, Professor Howell, how do you measure leadership in government?
Well, when it comes to the presidency in particular, I think the first thing that's worth recognizing are the extraordinary expectations that we have of presidents. You just had on your session, there's a live debate going on in Sacramento about what powers should be vested in the mayor. At the presidential level, there's an expectation that presidents attend to just about every conceivable issue. They don't get a pass on much of everything. And so I think a place to start the conversation is simply to recognize that presidents, in order to succeed generally, but particularly during times of crisis, they need to kind of own the moment. They need to assume ultimate responsibility. And those presidents who succeed are ones who put themselves at the center of a government's response and own the successes and failures that flow from it.
And do you believe our president has done this during the pandemic?
Well, it depends on which day we're talking about. There are moments when he verbally claims responsibility, just that there are other days when he openly disavows it and goes out of his way to criticize mayors and governors for their responses and tries to deflect responsibility. I'll say, when it comes to the presidency, at least historically, that's been politically a losing proposition. Mm-hmm. Presidents don't have that option. They don't get to say that's above my pay grade or that's somebody else's job, particularly when it comes to national crises, international crises of the form that this pandemic is obviously taking.
Right. Just a moment ago, I sort of posed the question, you know, are leaders born or made? And I wonder what your thoughts are on that. Those characteristics or traits that make up a good leader, how do they end up in us?
Well, I don't think it's either born or made. That's a kind of a stark comparison. There are plenty of people who have leadership qualities, but in a moment, the moment doesn't call for those qualities. And then there are plenty of people who occupy where the moment calls for it, but they occupy a position of power that doesn't allow for them to exercise their powers in a meaningful way. And I'll say again, vis-a-vis the presidency, the place to start is really in this confluence of public expectations as they relate to where the president sits. It's like the office itself, the powers that are given to it, and the fact that the president is a focal point in our politics, so that there are individuals who, you know, in other stations of government would not look like leaders, but boy, are they tested when they're put into the office of the presidency. And they better rise to the moment, because if they fail to do so, as in my view, this president is plainly failing to do so, all of their faults will be laid in stark relief.
Professor Howell, do you think that American citizens don't properly understand the powers that make up the presidency?
Well, I think there's lots of confusion generally when it comes to the operations of government in the broader public. I mean, what formal powers are given to much of anybody is a subject that much of the public doesn't understand. There is this schism between this expectation that presidents can solve every conceivable problem, right? They can do everything out there. And the fact that they actually face some real meaningful constraints, that some things they can't adequately do, some things are beyond their control. There's some domains when it comes to like war making, where presidents exert extraordinary authority. They both in decisions about when and whether to wage war, and then also how wars are prosecuted. But there are other domains in public education, in overseeing and managing national immigration policy, where presidents, look, they exert real influence. They have formal authority to speak of.
And that's part of the leadership, right? The influence.
That's right. That's right. But relative to the expectations that are put before them, where and you know, presidential candidates feed those expectations. We're seeing that now, you know, in this election, where presidents go out and they say, on day one, I will fix X, Y, and Z.
Right,
and they're not
right,
going to
yeah.
fix X, Y, and Z on day one. They can only do so much.
You hear that every 4 years, right? what's
yeah,
going to happen?
And all the time in between as well. It is this funny thing where those who would like to be president set themselves up for failure in this regard, because mm-hmm. they say, I can fix it. I can turn it all around. And then when they occupy the office, they can see how difficult doing so it actually is.
And the current president saying, I alone can fix this.
That's right. In mm-hmm. some moments, he says, right. I alone can fix it, which is this current president as populist. I mean, there's a real anti-democratic, small d, anti-democratic strain through this administration, which says, look, I will work outside of the traditional legislative process. I will work outside of and shouldn't be subject to the scrutiny of a free and independent press or an independent judiciary. Look to me to solve your problems.
Mm-hmm. Professor Howell, one of your main areas of focus is on this separation of powers. Help us, you know, without it being too much of a civics 101 lesson, help us understand how that works and how that isn't perhaps working right now when we're faced with something like a pandemic.
Sure. So separation of powers is this notion that was, I mean, sort of a central feature of our government, where power is divided across the various branches of government at the federal level, just as it's divided between the federal, state, and local levels. So power is always contested in our government. It's always fragmented. It's always set upon itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that is in no small part because the founders worried a great deal about concentrated authority being invested in any one person and a demagogue assuming power in the service of his. They only had he's in mind.
Directly coming from interest. A monarchy that was on the top of their mind, right?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And so you could see it can be seen as a safeguard against the emergence of tyranny on the one hand. But on the other hand, when it comes to coordinating a response to big public challenges like a pandemic, right, requires, it presents all kinds of challenges and difficulties. And when you have the polarization of the two major parties grafted on this system of separated powers, the possibilities to formulate a coordinated, effective response really are, well, they're really thin. They're really hard to come by.
Mm-hmm. And it's almost pushing those powers even farther apart. And this would also go to the handling of some demonstrations throughout the country calling for social change.
For sure. I mean, these protests are interesting because they could be seen both as kind of an effort outside of traditional forms of power to influence the doings of government. There's a kind of a recognition that our government is broken. And so rather than elect people to office, what we need to do is from the outside is pressure the government to change what it's doing. But then you also see Democrats and Republicans understanding these protests in very different terms, which underscores just how polarized and divided we are.
How do you feel governors have done both on the pandemic and with the demonstrations? They seem to have played major leadership roles in several states, including California, over the past 5 or 6 months.
Yeah, in some states, not in all states, but in some states, California is certainly one. You see governors stepping forward and exercising a kind of leadership and command of the moment and an effort to meet the moment on its own terms that, frankly, we haven't seen in the White House. To my mind, what this speaks to is the kind of vacuum left by the White House in the absence of formal authority and a command coming from the White House. Other governors have seen fit to step in, but they haven't done so uniformly. There are plenty of other governors who've taken their cues from the president and have seen to deflect and to minimize the crisis and, I mean, not call it as a crisis at all, and at every turn to insist that things are getting better, all facts to the contrary.
And this has pretty much split along political lines?
Largely. I mean, that's the first, if you're going to take a guess on whether or not a governor is trying to forthrightly attend to the issue, is drawing upon the expertise of public health experts, is willing to use the powers of the government in order to, you know, insist upon social distancing measures. If you only knew one fact and you were to make a guess, you'd want to know the partisanship. And Democratic governors tend to be doing that to a greater extent than Republican governors. Not all the way through, but for the most part.
Of the governors who have stepped in to fill that void that you mentioned, what qualities are you seeing that's working? What leadership qualities help them succeed at this?
Well, again, I think the first part is claiming responsibility. I think another part, though, has to do with recognizing the moment and the challenges it presents for what they are, right? Where there is uncertainty, recognizing uncertainty. Where there is a call to sacrifice, recognizing as much. That where political leaders, particularly executives, get into trouble is where they downplay something. Think about, you know, Bush in the aftermath, in a couple of years into the Iraq War, declaring that, you know, that victory had been won on an aircraft carrier, right?
Mission accomplished.
Banner in the background. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mission accomplished. Exactly. That kind of thing sets you up for all kinds of trouble. And so when you have months for Trump of insisting this is going to go away and that we're now coming in on 160,000 casualties around the country, there's no spin that gets around those facts. Mm. And so a core part of leadership is meeting the moment. And calling upon citizens to share in the sacrifice, to recognize the sacrifice that's involved in doing so.
So if some of the power is shifted to the presidency or on a local level like we have here to the mayor, what are some of the negative implications of that? I know that you argue that, you know, having that power might help in a situation like a pandemic because things just can't get done with this separation. And we are seeing that play out to some degree. So what would be the flip side of that? What's the negative implication of handing over that power?
Well, we already hinted to, which is a general concern about the concentration of authority in any one individual, right? So there's that. Another piece is that political leaders tend to focus their attention on the entirety of the jurisdictions that they're meant to serve. So when it comes to the presidency, they tend to have a more national outlook and a more long-term outlook than do legislators. And to the extent that you're concerned about the articulation of local concerns, international politics, when you shift authority away from Congress to the president, you know, the good people of Sacramento are going to have a little less, their voice is going to be tamped down a bit because policies will be cast in more national terms. Mm-hmm. Same thing within, you know, here within Chicago, we have our city council. It consists of 55 aldermen, each of which represent different portions of the city. And to the extent that mayors claim more authority here, then the attention will be paid on Chicago as a whole, as opposed to each of the neighborhoods that constitute Chicago. So I think, and that's a, you know, that's a, when we think about who should have power, we got to make it, you know, kind of think through those issues. Which yeah. kinds of views do we want to see articulated?
And there's a lot of power in vocalizing your thoughts and getting people on your side, that sort of thing. In the little time we have left, what role does social media play in this conversation when people in power use that to their advantage or, I guess, disadvantage in some cases?
Well, social media has played an increasing role in people's ability to get elected. It has also had a big role in shaping party brands and partisanship. And I'll say a big part of the debate about whether or not to vest authority in any office has to do with who happens to occupy, which party happens to occupy that source of authority. So I'm happy, Randall, giving you authority as long as you'll do my bidding. But as soon as you want to deviate, well, then I'm going to have all sorts of qualms with that. Right. And I think so. A lot of the debate then right now, you'd see, if you know, should we vest authority in the presidency? The first people are going to come out and say, no, we're going to be Democrats, as because they see it being put to Trump's political ends. But when that shifts,
right,
that storyline in turn will flip, and we'll see Republicans coming out excoriating, you know, the abuses of power of a Biden administration.
Similar arguments when it comes to whether or not to remove the filibuster and that sort of thing. So
for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can have a high-minded debate about whether or not, you know, 60 senators should be required to pass a law. But much of the debate ultimately comes down to whose ox is getting gored.
Right. Professor William Howell, he's a presidential scholar and Sidney Stein professor in American politics at the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. Thank you so much for sharing your perspective with us today.
It's good to be with you, Randall.
And still ahead, we'll speak with a woman who trains great leaders and get some takeaway tips you can use as you go about your Tuesday. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. If there's one thing that 2020 has shown us, is that leadership is so important and it can come at many, many different levels. Certainly in the news media and here at CAP Radio, we understand that leadership in these very trying times is critical to maintain and build credibility. So we want to leave you today with some tips for being a great leader. And we're turning to an expert from our own field of journalism who has this topic pretty dialed in. Jill Geisler is her name. She's the Bill Plant Chair in Leadership and Media Integrity at Loyola University, once again in Chicago. It's a Chicago heavy day today. She's also a Freedom Forum Fellow in Women's Leadership. Her guidance not only helps newsroom managers attain and keep credibility, but can easily translate to whatever it is you do or oversee so that you can be a better leader in that realm. A quick personal note, more than 20 years ago, Jill was a news director at a television station in Milwaukee. One of her producers, a good friend of mine, asked if she could carve out 30 minutes in her day to give me some career guidance. I wasn't exactly sure what I wanted to do at that point. She did, and I'll never forget how in the moment she was and engaged with me while I was sitting there. I was seriously nobody to her, some anchor reporter who drove over from the state capitol in Madison. But yet she focused and made me feel like the meeting was as important to her as it was to me. And I think that's definitely a leadership quality. So it was great to see her again 20 years later. And the first question I asked her, are the qualities of being a good leader born into us, or are they something that can be learned?
I think leadership is a skill that you practice constantly. It is not a God-given attribute or talent. It is something that you have to dedicate yourself to. It's a mindset and it's a skill set.
Mm-hmm. What do you think keeps some of us anyway from acting on leadership instincts? Because there's probably instincts within us, right?
Sure. In many cases, we have to think about what's right for the situation. There are some things that are universal. For example, people appreciate someone who is the calm in the storm, especially now in critical times. Now, some of us tend to be a little more excitable than others. And so you have to think, you know, you have to be self-aware and self-managing. What do they need from me right now? And what do I universally believe in? So you may not wake up each morning saying, I'm going to be calm in the storm, but you are going to say, I'm going to give people what they need. And if you know that you have a tendency to get flustered if you're under a lot of stress, then you make sure that you have deputies who are very good at what you're not, and you empower them to do two things. One is to act. The second thing is to tap you on the shoulder and to tell you when you need to up your game, because no leader is perfect. You know, you may have someone who is a great strategist, but forgets people's names. And that can be pretty awful if you forget somebody's name. But you may then have to manage yourself, right? Especially if you have a big team. You got to write things down, including the names of people or pets or partners that are important to them. Because again, I always operate from the principle that the most important thing leaders do is help other people succeed. And if it doesn't mean you have to be perfect, you may write the most convoluted memos that somebody has to interpret for you. That's not a great thing. But if in the main, you are a person who is known by everyone who is working with you as someone who's got their back, including telling them when they're not performing well, but you're telling it in the context of a complete diet of feedback, both good and bad.
What are some of the mistakes that we make when we think we're trying to be a good leader, but really the actions we're taking are undermining us along the way?
Many people who become in any position of power think that they have to solve all the problems. They tend to fix rather than coach. And they don't realize that people fall in love with ideas and solutions of their own creation. So rather than if someone comes to you and says, you know, I've got three really good candidates for this job, you shouldn't have a boss who says, okay, here's the one I want you to pick. You want a boss who says, well, as you're reviewing those candidates, tell me what you're thinking about each one and tell me how each one meets the most important goals we have. And you ask more questions so that by the time you're done with that, it's not a long conversation necessarily. The person has said to you, you know, it sounds to me like based on what we've talked about, candidate number three sounds good. And then you say, how do you feel about that? And unless you as a leader think that they're really on the wrong track, then you question whether you have had good conversations previously about goals are. But don't jump in and fix everything, especially when it comes to ideas. You know, you should set the vision. It's like you kind of build a skeleton. And then you let people help flesh that out with their ideas, because people in newsrooms will tell you this. An assigning editor will come to you and say, here's the story I want you to cover. And the reaction is usually, oh, great. Okay, fine.
I've seen it over and over.
But you get excited about it when you start to put your fingerprints on it. Well, maybe I could talk to this person. Well, here's something that hasn't been done before. So think of the difference if I come to you and say, instead of saying, Randall, here's a story I want you to do, if I say, Randall, I'm looking at this information and I think there's a story here, but I wonder if you can take a look and put your touch to it. And now it's a different conversation, right?
Right.
It becomes yours. You're not executing my idea. You are taking the germ of that idea and growing it. And a lot of leaders think that they have to have such control. Now, again, if you're in a really flawed, very toxic organization, you may have to come in as a leader and set some standards. And these are non-negotiable, right? You may have an idea that yelling at people and diminishing them is okay. Yeah, that's not going to be an idea we're going to go with. But mostly, it's not about toxic organizations. It's about organizations that need a vitamin from a good leader.
A vitamin from a good leader. I like that. So what about taking credit? As a leader, is that detrimental?
There are some things that employees never forgive or forget. And one is a boss who takes credit for their ideas, but doesn't take blame when things go wrong. And so truly, if you have confidence in yourself as a leader, and I hope you do, then giving credit to other people is one of the most fun things you can do. Because in truth, when you shine a light on them, a little bit of it spills off onto you too. But we, as individuals, we tend to remember negative feedback because it touches our emotions and it sticks, it hurts. And the good feedback that we get is often sort of offhanded, like, good job, you know, yeah, nice, I really enjoyed that. That doesn't stick. That doesn't have any staying power. But if I say something like, Randall, you know what I liked about the show today? The third guest you had on taught me something I had never heard before, especially when he said or she said. And now when you get that feedback, you're going to say to yourself, wow, Jill just told me about this specifically. I'm going to do more of that.
Mm-hmm. That you were, and it also proved to me that you were listening, which is what I got from you more than 20 years ago.
I tell leaders, your specificity proves your sincerity.
Yeah. Specificity. Wait, let me see if I can. Your specificity. Wait, I can't
you
say that
got
word.
It. No, and pronunciation.
I said it
right. Yes. Listen, it happens to me too. Your specificity.
Specificity.
In your feedback proves your sincerity. So the difference between good job and here's what I really liked about it. And so I've learned, even on an email, if someone sends me something to read or to listen to, I immediately think, which part of it am I going to capture and send back to them? Instead of just saying, good job, I thought it was really well written, I will say, in particular, this line really stuck out to me. Again, whatever you reinforce sincerely and specifically, you're probably going to get more of.
Right. Jill, there's an organization in Florida, the Poynter Institute, which trains journalists to be better journalists and also to be newsroom leaders. And you spent, what, 16 years there?
Yeah, I ran the leadership and management programs there.
Wow. So over that time, you have come in contact with so many newsroom leaders from across the country. I imagine some good, some bad. What was your takeaway in terms of what made a good leader that you met during that period? There must be a few qualities that you kept seeing over and over again.
Well, we would actually ask people, you know, in our leadership seminars, give us some of the qualities of the best leaders you've ever worked for. One of the things that consistently came up was they have a vision for where we're headed. They don't necessarily feel like they have to constantly drive the car. They have the vision and they, you know, and then they let us chart a course. They are calm in the storm. They have a decent sense of humor. They are seen as equitable. And it doesn't mean you have to treat everyone alike, right? Because an introvert doesn't necessarily want wild public praise. An extrovert might appreciate that. And you can't just assume that everyone is going to follow the same path you did. They may not organize their work in the same way you do. And so the people that are really respected as leaders know what to apply universally and then what to customize for each person. And so those leaders, they also had courage. They were the people who were the same person when their boss was in the room as when their boss wasn't around, right? Because we all know of people who suddenly change their personality and their behavior when like somebody above them is there. So they were really authentic. And then the two things that have come up repeatedly is a strong moral compass. And by strong moral compass, that's just not ethics. That also includes the real concept of inclusion, that they are always thinking about who's not in the room right now, whose voice, for whatever reason, isn't in this conversation. And we have to make sure we consider, we reach out to.
A big part of your current role there at Loyola is building credibility in newsrooms. And as you know, the news media has been a target from political leaders in the country as of late, knocking down their credibility. It's been under fire from the president of the United States since before he took office. And this is a time when it's so important for reporters and journalists to get their stories out about the pandemic, about the current calls for racial justice. How do you coach newsroom leaders regarding this moment we're in? Because it really is a bit different than what we've seen before.
Right. You know, first of all, the term news media is such a general term. Mm-hmm. It covers everything from, you know, Good Housekeeping magazine to Facebook for some people, to what otherwise would be called mainstream media. And it's important for people to know how the sausage is made in each one of those, because frequently you'll see a panel discussion on cable TV, and the people who are sitting around that panel, one of them is a journalist who is trying to tell you objectively what is happening, not to influence your decision making, but the person right next to them on the panel may be someone from an opinion outlet who is in fact trying to get you to be motivated to believe or to act in a certain way. And those things aren't always obvious to people. So anytime journalists who are serious about their work want to be taken really credibly, it is important to do what your math teacher said, which is show your work. Explain how you do your work. And I don't mean in a patronizing way. I mean, if you have made a tough call, if you're not going to show a graphic picture, or you are going to show a graphic picture, make sure that you take the time to explain why you are doing that. If you are going to use a term like racist to describe some language, it's really important to explain the history of that racist term and why you are calling it that kind of a term. One other thing, Randall, when the pandemic broke, I went online and I found that the CDC actually had put together a communication book for its own spokespeople. And you can find it online. And it was written in 2016, updated in 2018. And they say, if you're going to be the spokesperson, which is really what journalists are for news and information, they said, here are some of the things that we should look for: empathy and caring, competency and expertise, honesty, commitment and dedication, and accountability. And I looked at that and said, if that's what the CDC wants in a spokesperson, I think that's also what the public wants in the journalists who are bringing their stories forward. And so I would say, don't hesitate from the empathy standpoint, not just to tell the stories of people who have been so terribly harmed by this pandemic, but write from the heart and feel free to write about your own personal experiences, because that's how we connect to each other as human beings.
And that's really interesting, Jill, because I think a lot of reporters shy away from what you just described there, worrying that if they insert themselves too much in the story, then they lose their objectivity. But you could see it as transparency, right?
Right. This is not about telling people how you vote or how you pray or what your personal life with your spouse is or anything or your partner. But it really is about let me give you an example. There was a magnificent story about the 4th of July written by an Associated Press reporter named Russ Contreras. He's a general assignment reporter, but he's also on their race and ethnicity team. Hmm. And if you can look online and find it. But he wrote about how the 4th of July was not meaningful to him. In fact, he was angry on the 4th of July because of a history of racist acts toward his family and systemic racism. But he also wrote about an uncle who was a war hero and how he always reflects on his uncle, the war hero, and how he went back in when he didn't have to after he was injured. And Russ said, I'm going to go back in too. Now, nothing about writing about that history and that anger that he feels about systemic racism gets in the way, in the opinion of his management, from him reporting stories, because he still is an objective journalist, but you understand more about the context he brings. And I think those are important things for us to be real about, especially if our personal experiences help put a real face on a systemic or an important issue.
That's a great story that you just shared to describe that. I love that. Jill, for a sort of out the door tip, somebody is, you know, listening to us right now, getting ready to head out the door. What one thing can they change about their day to be a better leader?
I have a management mantra, which is life's too short to work with jerks. Don't hire them. Don't enable them. Don't be them, okay? Which means don't assume that because someone is brilliant They should be able to be difficult, right? I mean, we're all difficult in ways, but I'm talking about people who come to work and make it more difficult for people than it has to be. In a worst case scenario, make it toxic. So life's too short to work with jerks. If leaders remember that, they hire, they promote, they train accordingly, they run the day that way, we'll be fine.
That's Jill Geisler, the Bill Plant Chair in Leadership and Media Integrity at Loyola University in Chicago. She's also a Freedom Forum Fellow in Women's Leadership, and her website is whatgreatbossesknow.com. And I just got a tweet from a listener who says they'll give me a buck if I can say, your specificity shows your sincerity. There, I just did it. Okay, you can find more information about Jill or all of the guests we had on the show today at capradio.org/insight. And that's Insight for today. I'm Randall White, your producers. Cynthia Lopez, she was the woman driving this bus today, and Kyle McKinnon. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Chris Vera Phillips. Technical director is Mark Jones, engineer Antonio Munez, Insight's managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.